David Matthews, professor of virology at the University of Bristol, England, said, if you have been double-jabbed and then infected with Delta variant of coronavirus and recovered, then you have got a very broad, very effective immune response that probably covers pretty much any variant that you can think of. In this regard, we have prepared for you an article written by Linda Goetz under the heading, What Does Appearance of Omicron Variant Mean for the Double Vaccinated? The article was published by The Guardian Daily. Please stay tuned. The emergence of Omicron has prompted widespread speculation that it may be more resistant to COVID-19 vaccines than existing variants, including Delta. But what does that mean for the average double-vaccinated people? All the vaccines currently available in the UK work by training the immune system against the coronavirus spike protein, the key it uses to infect cells by binding to the ACE2 receptor. Omicron possesses more than 30 mutations in this protein, including 10 in the so-called receptor binding domain, RBD, the specific part that latches on to this receptor. Delta has 2 BRD mutations. However, even with all these changes, there will still be areas to which antibodies and T-cells, which grow in response to previous infection or vaccination, will be able to respond. Danny Altman, professor of immunology at Imperial College London, said, if you scribble the mutations on to a picture of the spike protein's crystal structure and relate that to all of the main antibody activities that we know about, it looks kind of terrifying, like most of your key neutralizing antibody target will be shot to pieces. So what's going to be left of your immune protection? Altman said, and yet the soundings we are getting from South Africa seem to be saying that it doesn't look severe, and the people who are going to hospital are the unvaccinated rather than the vaccinated, as the vaccination was still buying them some cover. Then there are T cells, immune cells that recognize and attack virus-infected cells and educate antibody-producing B cells about the viral risk they are facing. Altman said, we all think that the T-cells can see the differences between variants and that the T-cell repertoire is much more impervious to it, so that might also buy you some protection. The question is, how much protection? We know that people who have been double-jabbed can and do get infected with the Delta variant, although the chances of this happening are approximately 3 times lower than if they hadn't been vaccinated. More importantly, vaccinated individuals are roughly 9 times less likely to die if they do become infected. Although, it looks as though infection with Omicron is even more likely, Professor Paul Morgan, an immunologist at Cardiff University, said, I think a blunting rather than a complete loss of immunity is the most likely outcome, adding, the virus can possibly lose every single epitope on its surface, because if it did that, a spike protein couldn't work anymore. So, while some of the antibodies and T-cell clones made against earlier versions of the virus or against the vaccines may not be effective, there will be others, which will remain effective. Further boosting that protection by broadening access to third doses of COVID-19 vaccines is therefore a good idea. Morgan said, if half or two-thirds or whatever it is of the immune response is not going to be effective, and you're left with the residual half, then the more boosted that is, the better. For individuals who have been double jabbed and infected with Delta, the picture is better still. David Matthews, professor of virology at the University of Bristol, said if you have been double jabbed and then infected with Delta and recovered, then you have got a very broad, very effective immune response. That probably covers pretty much any variant that you can think of. This is because such individuals have been exposed to the virus through infection with Delta and the spike protein from the original Wuhan strain through vaccination. Matthew said it means you have got an antibody response that covers both classic and modern strains and a very broad T-cell response, not just against the spike protein, but against all other proteins that SARS-CoV-2 makes, and that's incredibly helpful. The biggest worry is for those who remain unvaccinated. Matthew said if they are right that this virus is even better at transmitting than Delta, and it looks like they are, what will happen is that it will speed up the rate at which this virus finds the unvaccinated and puts them in hospitals, and that will therefore increase the pressure on NHS, adding, that is what will trigger a lockdown if hospitalization rates go above a certain threshold, whatever that is. However, there are some reasons to be optimistic. The first is that we don't yet know how the Omicron variant will behave in a highly vaccinated population, such as the UK's. Dr. Peter English, a retired consultant in communicable disease control, said it is quite possible that people who have had two or better still three doses of existing vaccines will be well protected against it, adding, but it is also possible that we will have much less protection from existing vaccines against this new variant. We do not yet have enough information to know. Another is the existence of antiviral drugs such as Molnupiravir, to which Omicron should still be responsive. Nearly 500,000 doses of this twice-daily pill were due to be delivered this month and will be given as a priority to elderly COVID patients and those with particular vulnerabilities such as weakened immune systems through a national study being run by the NHS. Because the drug is most effective when given in the early stages of infection, the Medicines and Healthcare Products Regulatory Agency, MHRA, recommends it is used as soon as possible after a positive test for COVID and within 5 days of symptoms appearing. Existing therapies such as the anti-inflammatory drug dexamethasone are also likely to work against Omicron because it targets the body's response to the virus rather than the virus itself. Finally, there is the possibility of modifying the existing vaccines to match the Omicron variant if it really does evade vaccine-induced immune responses to a significant degree, something we won't know for a number of weeks. Dr. Peter English said mRNA and vector platforms allow very rapid changes to be made to the precise antigens used. This means that it would be possible relatively quickly, within a matter of months, to produce a vaccine with antigens tailored to a new variant. Omicron is undoubtedly a bump in the road leading us out of this pandemic and quite possibly a major pothole, but based on what we know so far, it seems unlikely to send us back to where we were a year ago. However, the more people who are fully jabbed and have access to those third doses, the more certain of this we are likely to be.
wildfires in Greece, Turkey, and Israel.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the Newsline.
Last week, the Israeli Minister of Military Affairs, Benny Gantz, made a two-day visit to Morocco. On Wednesday, Morocco and Israel signed a security cooperation agreement during a ceremony attended by Gantz and the Moroccan Defense Minister, Abdellatif Loudi. The agreement lays the foundation for security cooperation, intelligence sharing, and future arms sales between Israel and Morocco. The deal comes less than a year after Morocco normalized ties with the Israeli regime under a U.S. brokered accord following the footsteps of the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, and Sudan. The North African countries have had strained relations for decades. Algeria cut diplomatic ties with Morocco in August, citing hostile actions and Morocco's normalization of ties with Israel. Algeria holds Morocco responsible for leading a media war against the country, being involved in deadly forest fires, and backing separatist groups. Moreover, Algeria has rebuked the recently signed security cooperation agreement between Morocco and Tel Aviv. The Algerian president, Abdelmadjid Tebboune, deplored the deal and described Morocco's threats against his country as unprecedented and disgraceful. He even warned to retaliate against any attacks against his country. Also, the Senate President Salah Gujil said that Gantz's visit to Morocco had targeted his country.
Well, as you know, the Israeli government, along with the United States, has been pushing for recognition among African countries and Arab countries as well. The so-called Abraham Accord has been imposed on several states, including the Republic of Sudan. Algeria has consistently resisted this type of pressure from the United States and from Israel.
Morocco's agreement with Israel also drew condemnation from the Palestinians. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas urged Morocco to sever ties with Israel. It slammed the agreement as a great sin against the Palestinian cause and a move against the strategic goals of the Arab world that cannot be justified under any pretexts. The dispute in the Western Sahara region has been a decades-long bone of contention between the two neighbors. Morocco annexed the vast Western Sahara region, a former Spanish colony, in the 1970s, and has since been in conflict with Polisario Front independence movement that seeks to end Morocco's presence in the region. Algiers, on the other hand, supports the Polisario Front that seeks independence for Western Sahara, which is claimed by Morocco as its territory. The border between the two countries has been closed since the year 1994.
The statehood, just like every other African country that was colonized, had a right to establish their own government and their own sovereignty. So that could go a long ways towards resolving the conflict in the Western Sahara and between Algeria and Morocco.
Following Morocco's normalization of ties with Israel last year, then U.S. President Donald Trump agreed to recognize Morocco's sovereignty over Western Sahara, abandoning a long-standing U.S. policy on the region. The Algeria-backed and pro-independence Polisario Front rejected in the strongest terms Trump's stance on the disputed Western Sahara desert region, stating that the former U.S. president attempted to give to Morocco that which does not belong to it. Also, Algeria later rejected the agreement, saying the U.S. decision has no legal effect because it contradicts U.N. resolutions, especially U.N. Security Council resolutions on Western Sahara.
Thank you.
Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, the former head of the Iranian Defense Ministry's Organization of Defensive Innovation and Research, was assassinated on November 27, 2020, when the car he was riding in came under attack near his countryside residence east of Tehran. Fakhrizadeh had reportedly been on Israel's hit list since at least 2007.
This is how Dr. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, head of Project Abad, put it. Remember that name, Fakhrizadeh.
But he wasn't the only Iranian scientist to have been targeted by Israel. The regime made several assassination attempts between 2007 and 2012 that claimed the lives of four nuclear scientists and wounded another. That's on top of sabotage attacks on Iran's nuclear sites that have become more frequent over the past months. Iran has vowed to continue the work on its peaceful nuclear program. The international community, however, was largely silent over the recent assassination, a similar attitude of indifference that displayed toward Israel's airstrikes on Syria and its aggression on the Palestinian people.
Point is simple. Israel is America's most important friend and ally in the Middle East and in North Africa. Israel is exempt from prosecution in the eyes of America simply because without Israel, America's position in the Middle East and in North Africa would be in serious jeopardy.
Iran has vowed a harsh response against those behind the attacks on Iranian nuclear scientists and sites. A report published by the New York Times suggests that the United States has called on Israel to stop its attacks on Iran's nuclear program, suggesting that they could help strengthen Iran's capabilities. The article cites officials familiar with the discussions who said Washington has told Tel Aviv that the attacks are ultimately counterproductive, as Iran has been able to replace the damaged centrifuges with newer and much more capable ones within months. According to the article, the U.S. officials have admitted that Iran has improved its defenses, including with regard to its cybersecurity, rendering an attack similar to the Stuxnet virus extremely difficult to succeed. Israeli officials have reportedly rejected the U.S. call, saying they don't have any intention of ending their anti-Iran policies. Yet the credibility of the whole report is under question, as Washington and Tel Aviv hardly disagree on matters, especially in the case of Iran.
The Americans understand that Israel's actions often cannot be defended publicly, so it cannot always be seen in public as siding with the Israelis. So that is why from time to time the Americans will issue a public statement saying that they have issued a caveat to Tel Aviv about their actions vis-a-vis Lebanon or vis-a-vis Iran.
The report could also be a scare tactic in an attempt to obtain concessions ahead of the key talks in Vienna on the obligations of the parties to the 2015 Iran nuclear deal. But Iran has repeatedly stated its firm position that the talks must end in the removal of all anti-Tehran sanctions.
On life support, in tatters, and on the verge of collapse. These are some of the terms that have been used to describe the current status of the hard-earned nuclear deal that emerged in 2015 after so many rounds of painstaking diplomacy between Iran and the P5+1 group of countries. The deal is almost dead, with the U.S. having abandoned it, the European parties failing to abide by their commitments or make up for the damage from the U.S. withdrawal, and Iran having rolled back some of its commitments. Who's to blame for the status quo? Many point the finger at former American President Donald Trump and his favorite maximum pressure policy involving a long list of anti-Iran sanctions. His successor, Joe Biden, a vociferous critic of Trump's confrontational approach, has insisted that he wants to return to the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. But after taking office in January, His administration has enforced every single sanction that the former president imposed against the Iranians. This has led Iran to doubt Biden's seriousness. Iran and the P4 plus one group, namely Russia, China, Britain, France, and Germany, held six rounds of talks in the Austrian capital, Vienna, between April and June to find a path back into compliance with the deal. But critics say the Biden administration missed that window of opportunity by refusing to make up for America's unilateral withdrawal and provide proper assurances that it will not violate the deal again. Despite this, the involved parties are going to give diplomacy another chance with a new round of talks scheduled to take place later this month. Discussions are set to resume in Vienna next week. Top negotiators from Iran, Russia, China, Britain, France, and Germany will sit down for talks again. U.S. representatives will also be in the city, but not in the same room, as Iranians won't directly talk to the party that unilaterally withdrew from the international deal. What are the talks' chances of success? Iran says to be successful, the dialogue must lead to the removal of sanctions. Tehran also insists that America must offer guarantees that it will not abandon the deal again. The U.S. has repeatedly rejected Iranian demands for such guarantees. How is the U.S. planning to deal with its seriously damaged credibility? The head of Iran's permanent mission to the international organizations in Vienna said this week that the United States should prove its goodwill by removing sanctions against Tehran. During a meeting of the International Atomic Energy Agency's Board of Governors, he said that the credible and effective lifting of sanctions is the basis of Iran's willingness to abide by the terms of the agreement. He said it is unfortunate that European countries still do not want to openly condemn the unilateral withdrawal of the United States and the reimposition of sanctions, which is the only cause of all current problems.
First of all, in order to understand Europe, you have to understand the European Union. To understand the European Union, you have to understand it is under the control of Germany. Germany is a vassal state of the United States of America. Germany was conquered after World War II, where they lost the war, and they have been a vassal state ever since that time. The vassal does not tell the sovereign what to do. That's why they're not arguing with the United States. The United States tells them what to do, not the other way around.
It is definitely hard to guess what direction the talks will take, but the next meeting could shed light on how the two sides will approach the discussions.
Fourth Thursday of November in the United States, people hold ceremonies to celebrate Thanksgiving. The annual Thanksgiving holiday tradition in the U.S. goes back to when English settlers arrived at U.S. coasts. The landing was followed by a religious celebration by the settlers, but it proved disastrous for the indigenous people living there. It was just the beginning of pillage perpetrated in the service of European expansionism. Native Americans were greatly affected by the European colonization of the Americas. The annual celebration has come to symbolize the genocide of Native Americans.
The day known as Thanksgiving has extremely racist origins in the United States. It's a holiday marked by the U.S. government that represents the genocide, the enslavement of indigenous peoples. It was marked as a celebration of the bloodshed of Native Americans on their own land by white settlers from Europe who settled on this land.
Many believe Thanksgiving, marking the birth of the U.S., leaves out painful truths about the nation's history. Presenting Thanksgiving to children as primarily a happy time trivializes the trials and tribulations of the continent's indigenous population. The United American Indians of New England meet each year at Plymouth Rock on the Coles Hill to mourn.
To this day, there are indigenous peoples who are being pushed out of their lands in the United States. The Navajo Nation, Apache Nation, the Chumash Nation, the Iroquois Nation, all across the United States, indigenous people, they're still resisting and fighting the settler colonial project known as the United States.
They gather to remember and reflect in the hope that America will never forget the sacrifices and tragedies of its native people. The United American Indians of New England declared Thanksgiving a national day of mourning 50 years ago. It is a day of remembrance and spiritual connection, as well as a protest of the racism and oppression which Native Americans continue to experience to this day.
So the roots of Thanksgiving are actually a celebration of a massacre of innocent women and young children and families who were on their lands and were brutally murdered in horrific ways by these foreigners who came from England, from Holland, from other European nations. And at its core, this represents the foundation of the U.S. imperialist system of the United States as a nation, as a country.
Native Americans have endured genocide, discrimination, the abduction of their children, deliberate infection with smallpox, forced labor, and other abuses inflicted on them by their non-indigenous oppressors. They were banished by the 1830 Indian Removal Act to largely barren reservations in the American West, and they have remained invisible to the rest of the country ever since. In the U.S. today, Native American households are 19 times as likely as white households to lack indoor plumbing. African Americans and Latin Americans are twice as likely. Some Native American families have to drive an hour or more to retrieve fresh water.
Discrimination against indigenous peoples on the United States remains extremely rampant. Right now, as we speak, indigenous peoples are the poorest nation, the poorest communities of all other groups. They have the highest level of poverty, even compared to Black and Latino communities in the U.S. Indigenous peoples have no sovereignty over their land. They're forced to live on reservations, what they call them, which are huge concentration camps where there is oftentimes no running water, no clean infrastructure, no connectivity to the outside world, very few hospitals, very few schools.
300,000 members of the Navajo Nation, which spans New Mexico, Arizona, and Utah, represent 75% of all households in the U.S. living without electricity. The vulnerability of Native Americans to COVID-19 is disproportionately high compared with other populations.
Poverty, discrimination, a lack of health care, lack of education, lack of proper housing, and even worse is repression of indigenous peoples through police brutality, through the military-industrial complex, through violence. One of the biggest issues that has plagued indigenous communities in the United States are work sites, mining sites, backed by these huge European banks.
Poor health amongst Native Americans is caused by many contributing factors, including high rates of poverty, isolated geography, poor education and nutrition, inadequate sewage disposal, unhealthy living conditions, to name a few. Alcoholism is chronic and widespread, spanning all age groups, and heroin use among some tribes is four times higher than elsewhere. The serious issues with mental health among Native Americans are closely linked to other risk factors. Native Americans have the highest unemployment rates across the country. All of these problems that were just mentioned are a result of the U.S. and its takeover of Native Americans and their land, which to this day, Native Americans are suffering as a consequence.
Is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave radio, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 49 meters, 6040 kHz, and in southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters 11,880 kHz every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the Internet. Our Internet address is pastoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, if you might remember, we talked about Imam Khomeini's recommendations on supporting the oppressed and fighting the oppressors, especially the global arrogance and Zionism. We will continue the discussion in this episode. Stay tuned, please. Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, in his testament stresses that one of the main problems of the Islamic countries and oppressed nations are the mercenary regimes of these countries. He believes that these regimes try to keep these nations weak, backward, and dependent. He writes, "At least for the recent 100 years, that the big world-devouring powers gradually put their steps in the Islamic countries and other small countries, we have witnessed or have been told by correct histories that none of the ruling governments in these countries have thought of their nation's freedom, independence, and welfare. Almost all of them have rather been engaged in oppression and suffocation of their nation or have only tried for their vested or group interests, or for the welfare of the wealthy and upper class, and the oppressed slum-habiting classes have been denied all life blessings such as water and bread, and those miserable have been employed for the interests of the wealthy and debauchee stratum, or they have been the puppets of big powers, which have employed whatever they can to make countries and nations dependent and have made countries the markets of the East and the West through different tricks." and have secured their interest and have raised nations backward and consumers, and they are moving with the same plan. Imam Khomeini writes in his testament, "The misery for Muslims are the governments that are dependent on the East and the West, and I emphatically recommend you not to listen to the propaganda horns of the opponents of Islam and the Islamic Republic, which all try to expel Islam from the scene so that the interests of the superpowers are secured." Imam Khomeini also writes, "O you, the oppressed of the world, and you, the Islamic countries and Muslims of the world, stand up and grasp the right with hands and teeth, and do not be scared of the propaganda ballyhoo of superpowers and their servile stooges, and expel from your countries the criminal rulers who submit your efforts to your enemies. And expel from your countries the criminal rulers who submit your efforts to your enemies. And you and the committed serving classes take the helms of affairs and gather together under the flag of Islam to rise up for defense against the enemies of Islam and the deprived of the world." Imam Khomeini believed that confronting the media hype of the oppressive powers is the main duty of Muslims. He writes, "Today and in the future, what must be important for the Iranian nation and the Muslims of the world is the foiling of the disuniting and destructive propaganda." Elsewhere in his testament, the Imam writes, "I recommend Muslims, particularly the Iranians in the current era, to show reaction against conspiracies, increase their solidarity and unity in any possible way, and disappoint the disbelievers and the hypocrites." Imam Khomeini says, "The prominent ulema and respectable preachers of the Islamic countries should invite governments to free themselves of dependence of big powers and come to mutual understanding with their nation, as in this way they will embrace victory. And let them invite nations to unity and refrain from racism, which is opposite to Islam. And let them shake the hands of fraternity with their brothers in faith in any country and from any race, because the great Islam has called them brothers. And if this brotherhood in faith materializes through the efforts of governments and nations with the help of Almighty God, you will see that Muslims will form the greatest power in the world, with the hope of the day on which, God willing, this fraternity and equality will materialize." Imam Khomeini also writes, "I recommend the Islamic nations to take the role model of the Islamic Republic government and the Iranian struggling nation to put the oppressive governments in their place. If they do not capitulate to the will of their nations, the source of misery of Muslims are the governments that are dependent on the East and the West."
Of Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pourreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
said. I mean, all of me, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Gimpo City, already famous for its busy airport, now boasts a new landmark, a park just 1.4 kilometers from North Korea. The Aegipong Peace Eco Park, the South's nearest park to the north, is already open. It features an observatory, an exhibition hall, and much more, drawing large numbers of tourists eager to get a detailed look at North Korea. The park is scheduled to be complete by June, when a skywalk linking the two facilities will become operational.
My thought about the unification between North Korea and South Korea has been changed. People coming here, I think, and North Korean people are far away from our ordinary life.
Aside from telescopes, there's a peace bell made of melted metal, including empty cartridges found at the remains of soldiers killed in the Korean War. There is also a Christmas tree which once stood at a South Korean military observatory here.
Christian groups used to hold a Christmas Eve service next to a huge lit Christmas tree visible from the north across the estuary at this observatory and broadcast the service into the north by loudspeakers. This angered Pyongyang.
I can view apartments and farmers working in fields as close as Kaepung County, and I see a higher living standard than I thought the north had.
In the exhibition hall, the north can be viewed through a glass wall. Items on display reveal Aegipong's history and the need to preserve peace in the estuary, an ecological treasure trove untouched by humans since the Korean War's end. It is home to endangered species of birds, among others. There is also a unification-promoting virtual reality train that visitors take to Gaesong right across the estuary from the park, the next best thing to actual travel.
Visitors see images recovered with 3D technology of UNESCO World Heritage Sites in Gaesong.
The 17-day Gimpo Peace Festival, held last month to mark the park's launch and foster North-South peace and reunification, featured a tour press briefing by Gimpo's mayor and a peace conference by ambassadors on October 5th, when foreign journalists got a sneak preview of the park before it opened 2 days later.
I believe visitors do not need to fear North Korean attack here, since the world's powerful nations will not let a second Korean War occur.
Aegipong Peace Eco Park, which has replaced the South's military observatory in Gimpo, has been popular, drawing 15,000 tourists since opening. Not surprisingly, the park, which offers free admission through this year, is due to start charging an entrance fee soon, beginning next year. Jennifer Chang, Gimpo, South Korea.
Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi has attended the 15th summit of the Economic Cooperation Organization in Turkmenistan. Addressing the one-day summit on Sunday, he assured Iran's neighbors that Washington's sanctions will have no bearing on regional cooperation and interaction.
The United States' cruel sanctions against Iran will not have the slightest impact on the Islamic Republic of Iran's policy of maximum interaction with neighboring and regional countries.
Raisi called on member states to work together in a range of fields, from the creation of a regional electricity market to water transfer projects, as well as energy ventures. He also proposed creating an internal financial mechanism by the Economic Cooperation Organization to boost its efficacy. On the sidelines of the summit, Raisi held a string of high-level bilateral meetings to discuss ways to develop relations. The Iranian president has time and again said boosting cooperation with neighboring countries is one of the major goals of his administration. He believes that approach will help improve economy as well as peace and stability in the region. Iran took a big step in this regard in September when it formally became a full member of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. That's a Eurasian political, economic, and security alliance, accounting for about one-third of the world's land and exporting trillions of dollars in goods annually. Recently, Iran's Deputy Foreign Minister Ali Bagheri Kani traveled to several regional countries, including Qatar, the United Arab Emirates, and Oman, for talks on expanding bilateral cooperation. This month, he also went to four European countries, namely France, Germany, Britain, and Spain, where similar talks took place. Bagheri Kani's European tours came ahead of talks set to begin Monday in Vienna.
the talks taking place between Iran and other remaining signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal aim to remove sanctions on Tehran. Those sanctions took effect after the U.S. left the nuclear deal in 2018 as part of a so-called maximum pressure campaign seen as an attempt to isolate Iran in international arena. More than 3 years into that policy, it seems that it has failed, with Iran expanding ties with countries in the region and beyond while being accepted by more international bodies.
Each year, nearly 18 million visitors pass through Chinatown. But since the start of the pandemic in 2019, business owners here have struggled with a drop in sales, vandalism, and boycotts.
East and Southeast Asians make up the UK's third largest racial minority. Nonetheless, they are underrepresented here, depicted in a negative light on television, and anti-Asian racism is alive and well. Meanwhile, British politicians stand accused of making matters worse.
Remember Jacob Rees-Mogg, the leader of the House? Only recently he said something about yellow peril, and then he said, oh, I didn't know it's a racist statement. That's what the British government is. They continuously making statement about, you know, Chinese and then saying, oh, I didn't know it was racist. I mean, in other circumstances, if you say the N-word or the P-word nowadays, everyone noticed that it is a racist term, not for the Chinese.
China's growing influence worldwide is being observed with some chagrin in Western countries. And with governments choosing to dub COVID-19 the China virus, attacks on East and Southeast Asians has gone up, in the UK by 300%.
There's a bias there. And so it's a combination of things that they feel it's a small community. They feel as if they're guests. And I think the fact that for a better part of a year now, numerous Asians, and that's not just Chinese, Koreans, Japanese, Filipinos, have been getting bashed out of them because of Donald Trump's anti-Asian rhetoric.
In 2020, British media fueled anti-Asian hate by using images of East or Southeast Asian people in 33% of COVID-19 media stories, when in reality they make up less than 2% of the UK population, and nothing was done to stamp it out. Tensions ran high at Saturday's protest. The unverified word on the street is the counter-protest was funded by far-right nationalist groups who are using COVID-19 as an opportunity to promote anti-globalization sentiment and protectionist measures like closing borders. Bianca Rahimi, London.
The talks in Vienna mark a new round of negotiations between Iran and the P4+1, the group of remaining signatories to the nuclear accord after the U.S. withdrawal in 2018. The core issue for Tehran is the removal of the sanctions Washington has imposed on Iran ever since. Iran says it wants to see the sanctions removed all at once before the country returns to full compliance with its own obligations, because it was the U.S. that triggered the spiral down to the current situation by abandoning the nuclear agreement.
What is the center of focus in Vienna will be removing sanctions that have been imposed against Iran in a unilateral, extraterritorial, tyrannical, and illegal manner. The only thing that would help the U.S. is admitting that it's to blame for the current situation. It should remove the sanctions and give us a firm guarantee.
Iran says the talks can even lead to an immediate agreement. Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian says what the U.S. needs to do is to fully return to its obligations and walk back the sanctions in a verifiable manner. Amir Abdollahian told the European Union's foreign policy chief Joseph Borrell that sufficient and strict guarantees are also needed to ensure that a future U.S. government will not pull out of the deal again. Washington, however, has indicated that it's not ready to take those steps.
Let's see what they say when they're at the table. But obviously the indications they've given are not particularly encouraging. If those are the kinds of demands they make, that's tantamount to saying we don't really want a deal. We just want to spend the next few months building our nuclear program.
Iran began rolling back its commitments under the nuclear deal a year after the U.S. withdrawal and amid European signatories' failure to compensate for Washington's pullout. Iran originally accepted the accord's restrictions on its nuclear program in return for the economic benefits the removal of sanctions offered. However, those benefits never fully materialized due to Washington's continued pressure on Iran's potential economic partners. With sanctions back in full force under Donald Trump, Iran saw no point in unilaterally fulfilling its commitments. The country has repeatedly said even the rollback of its commitments fall strictly within the terms stated in Article 37 of the nuclear deal.
Iran has stated that if sanctions are reinstated in whole or in part, Iran will treat that as grounds to cease performing its commitments under this JCPOA in whole or in part.
Tehran says it's ready for a full return to its commitments if other signatories do the same. However, the administration of Joe Biden, who was the U.S. vice president when the nuclear deal was signed, has been dragging its feet, driving Iran to stand its ground on the outcome it wants to see out of the talks.
The All Parties Conference is convened in the commercial hub of Pakistan to condemn the UK's move of declaring Hamas a terrorist organization.
Participants of the conference stressed on the need for unity among Muslims and called on the international community to take serious notice of what they call the unilateral action of the old colonial power, the UK, who gave birth to the Zionist regime in the heart of Muslim world.
The conference was organized by Palestine Foundation of Pakistan, aiming to launch further series of week-long activities across the country.
We are all very much disturbed because of the United Nations and the United States policies about the Palestine and about the Israel. Israel is killing Muslims in all over the Palestine, and they are burning the houses and the colonies of the Muslim and building up the colonies for the Jews.
It's a clear nonsense because, you know, the Hamas is the only representative of the Palestinian. All the organizations, they represented by the peoples, they do not involve in terrorism. The UK and Australian have their own terrorist organization, which was supported by UK. Our terrorists from Karachi is in UK, and they were giving the shelter to them. So this is a nonsense, and we do not accept that, and we condemned it.
The UK's move in November coincided with Balfour Declaration in 1917, when British colonial imperialist power created the Zionist apartheid.
Actually, Israel is defeating. Israel will be no more in the map of world in nearby future. So that's why their creator, especially British government and United States administration, they are worried.
Participants called on the Prime Minister Imran Khan to do more than mere condemnation of the UK's government, that instead of apologizing and correcting its historical wrongs across the world and against the Palestinian people, is supporting the aggressor both in Kashmir and Palestine. Mohammed Turi, Karachi.
The 23rd Mediterranean Exchange of Archaeological Tourism has wrapped up in Paestum, a site in central southern Italy recognized by UNESCO as part of the World Cultural Heritage. The three-day initiative aimed to promote sites and destinations of great archaeological value and increase business opportunities. Some 100 conferences and meetings took place during the international event that has seen the participation of more than 150 exhibitors from 15 countries. Syria was among them, with a stand presenting the current state of the Palmyra World Heritage Site in the Homs province after the destruction by Daesh.
In 2015, Daesh militants seized the modern town of Palmyra first and then ancient ruins nearby. The militants initially promised to leave the sites, temples, and columns untouched. However, those promises went on to be unfulfilled.
Daesh attacked Palmyra's archaeological sites with bulldozers and explosives until 2016. The region of Palmyra was then freed from Daesh by a coalition of Syrian-Russian military forces on March 24, 2016. during the Mediterranean Exchange of Archaeological Tourism, an International Archaeological Discovery Award for the most valuable discovery of the year was assigned. The award is named after Khaled al-Assad, the archaeologist of the site of Palmyra who was brutally murdered by Daesh for trying to protect the cultural heritage. Max Civili, Pestum.
In an event in the Yemeni capital Sana'a, Yemen's Prime Minister Abdulaziz bin Habtour honored the Press TV for its prominent role in standing by the Yemeni people and exposing the crimes of the Saudi led coalition since the beginning of the war.
I would like to thank Press TV and its crew for standing by the Yemeni people in the face of the war imposed on us. Press TV reveals the truth about the war that has taken place between the axis of resistance and the U.S. proxies in the region. Sana'a is just one of the front lines of this confrontation. We greatly appreciate every effort made by satellite channels that honestly expose the crimes of the Saudi-led coalition and reveal the suffering of Yemenis to the world amid the continuing war and siege imposed by Saudi Arabia.
Participants said the Press TV has always been supporting the Yemeni people and its major role is clear through its continuing existence in the field to keep pace with the advancements of the Yemeni army and the Saudi violations against Yemenis.
Press TV is one of the leading channels that serves as a role model for free media and contributes to the resistance of the Yemeni people. This channel has had a prominent impact on Yemenis by keeping pace with every event, whether the victories of the Yemeni army or the crimes of the Saudi-led coalition. So Press TV deserves to be honored and appreciated by the Prime Minister.
Since the beginning of 2015, Yemenis have been suffering under war and siege imposed by Saudi Arabia. The United Nations describes Yemen as the world's worst humanitarian crisis and says millions of Yemenis, including children, are on the brink of famine.
Observers say Saudi Arabia has used thousands of media outlets to spread its propaganda and mislead the free people of the world about its war crimes in Yemen. Therefore, as observers say, the resistance media outlets should stand together against the Saudi-led coalition media war. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Iran's representative at the International Atomic Energy Agency addresses a virtual session of the IAEA's Board of Governors. Mohammad Reza Qaebi says the Islamic Republic's first priority at the upcoming talks to revive the nuclear deal, known as the JCPOA, will be the effective and verifiable removal of U.S. sanctions without any further delay and any preconditions.
The principal position of the new government of the Islamic Republic of Iran is that the first priority and issue that should be considered seriously into consideration is removal of all illegal sanctions imposed against Iran after the withdrawal of the U.S. from the deal.
Qaebi said the U.S. needs to address concerns arising from its 2018 withdrawal from the agreement, the least of which is how its possible future adherence can be relied upon. Iran has also criticized European states for requesting that Tehran implement its commitments under the deal, saying that until sanctions are not removed, it's not reasonable to expect more forbearance from the country. During the previous rounds of talks on reviving the JCPOA, Iran made it clear it wanted all U.S. sanctions, including additional ones imposed under the previous administration of Donald Trump, to be removed. Up until now, Tehran says, the administration of Joe Biden has not only failed to mitigate the U.S. maximum pressure policy, but has actually exacerbated it. Delegates from Iran, the three European states of Britain, France, Germany, plus Russia and China, are expected to resume negotiations on Monday here at Vienna's Hotel Coburg, the same venue where talks to reach the nuclear agreement concluded more than 6 years ago. Homa Lezgi, Vienna.
Lebanese resistance movement Hezbollah denounced Australia's decision to list the whole group as a terrorist organization, saying it was, quote, a human